time for catch up on stories from around the world this week on World Report with Adam Maguire.
Good morning. On today's programme, Canada's attempted crackdown on car thefts and a night on Istanbul's Taksim Square. But first, we go to southern Lebanon, where there are 332 Irish peacekeepers stationed at Camp Shamrock, close to the Blue Line, the effective border with Israel. Almost 300 people, including Lebanese and Israeli civilians, have been killed by Hezbollah rocket attacks and by Israeli airstrikes since October 7th, when Hamas attacked Israel. RT's Justin McCarthy spent the week in southern Lebanon and experienced firsthand the escalation in hostilities in the area.
It wasn't even 8 o'clock in the morning when the rocket fire went off, a series of deafeningly loud explosions. I was eating an army breakfast of porridge and hard-boiled eggs in the cookhouse of Camp Shamrock when the first blast sounded. I looked up, a tannoy rang out, a shout went up, groundhog, groundhog, the code word to take cover in defensive positions. It was also the signal to get on my UN-issued flak jacket and helmet, grab my respirator, and run like hell for cover. There are bunkers situated all across the camp. They're made from thick padded material, filled with stone chipping, and designed to protect against shrapnel or a misfired rocket. The blasts kept going as we ran. A soldier grabbed my bag to move me on quicker, and we ducked inside our bunker, with the explosions still going off. In all, 37 rockets were fired, one after another, from a position just 900 metres from this camp. The UN troops here are not the target, but the rockets used by Hezbollah are inexact. They're fired at an angle from a rail and can sometimes misfire or drop short of their target, putting lives here in danger. Within seconds of being launched, Israel's Iron Dome weapons system kicked in, shooting down the rockets, posing a threat to Israel. The system is calculated not to waste resources on rockets which are not going to harm Israelis. When the rocket attack was over, the soldiers sat and waited. An attack like this will usually provoke a counterstrike by Israel, which would send its fighter jets to launch a missile at the rocket launching site with a view to taking out any Hezbollah operatives in the area. Hezbollah has a powerful presence in this part of South Lebanon. In the towns and villages close to the border, there are large posters of the martyred dead, the fighters killed by Israel. The Irish peacekeepers working in this area are careful to avoid these towns and villages when funerals are taking place and emotions are running high. In a country like Lebanon, where firearms are commonly carried by civilians, you don't want to find yourself as an interloper in the narrow streets of a crowded village where anger, guns and tears are a potent mix. During my assignment here, I witnessed two Israeli airstrikes in the valleys below Camp Shamrock. A faint whoosh, then a thud, and plumes of black-grey smoke rise from the ground as the missiles strike their targets. As I took out my phone to grab some footage of the aftermath of one of the strikes, a soldier pointed me to higher ground where I could get a better photo. As we watched the unfolding chaos, he said to me, "You know, the sad thing is that someone has probably been killed over there." And that is part of the surrealism of life in South Lebanon. One minute you're eating breakfast or drinking a coffee, the next you're sheltering from bombs. Many of the palatial homes in the towns and villages around here are lying empty or are half-built. The civilians here are the double victims of a currency crash which has decimated Lebanon's economy. And now this, the daily attacks back and forth across the border with Israel. For the Irish soldiers working with the UN, the job of peacekeeping is undermined every day by these attacks. It is impossible to keep the peace in a country teetering on the brink of war. They maintain a good relationship with locals by meeting civic leaders and facilitating funding for projects like football pitches and streetlights. Some people, though, view the UN with suspicion, which can lead to tensions. But by and large, the presence of the soldiers here means that the world has eyes and ears on what is happening in South Lebanon, and that is at least of some comfort to the people living here, who are trying to make a life in a country which is anything but normal. Justin McCarthy for World Report at Camp Shamrock in southern Lebanon.
In Canada, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau recently convened a one-day summit in Ottawa to deal with surging numbers of auto thefts across the country. The meeting brought together police, lawmakers, insurance companies, automakers and border services to address what many are now calling an epidemic. Even before the summit, the Trudeau government had earmarked $121 million to help prevent gun and gang violence in Ontario, and that included tackling criminals who steal vehicles. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, it also prompted the Premier of that province, Doug Ford, to deliver this message to car thieves: "We're coming after you."
Not only has the number of auto thefts across Canada dramatically increased, they've become more brazen and violent. In Laval, Quebec, a car salesman was almost run over during a brazen daylight car theft at his dealership. Residents in some neighbourhoods of Toronto say they're terrified after alleged thieves broke into a home with one objective in mind: to steal key fobs so they can take the owner's vehicles. One home surveillance video shows two suspects throwing a brick through a window to get into a house. They allegedly took the keys to a Mercedes GLA and drove it away. The owner of the home, Megan, said never in her wildest dreams did she think somebody would go as far as breaking into her house to find her keys. And the incident in October wasn't the first time. In 2022, a Jeep Wrangler was stolen from her driveway. She says she's absolutely terrified and traumatized. Two more homes in the area were also the targets of similar attacks. Most people refuse to speak to the media over safety concerns. On other occasions, armed thieves have pulled drivers out of their vehicles at gunpoint and then driven away. Police in Toronto say the number of auto thefts taking place in the city has more than doubled since 2019. As of October, officials say nearly 9,500 vehicles have been reported stolen in Toronto alone last year, an increase of 30% from the year before. Authorities say more than 100,000 vehicles were stolen across Canada last year. That means a car is stolen just about every 5 minutes. One city that appears to be a main target for auto theft is Brampton, Ontario, northwest of Toronto. Its mayor, Patrick Brown, says two members of his city council have had their cars stolen, and one member had his car stolen twice. Some residents say it's escalated to car thieves breaking into homes, knowing residents are home, knowing they're on camera, knowing the alarms are on, and they're still coming. Police in Toronto say the level of violence being used in auto thefts represents a new and evolving threat to public safety. Officials say investigators are working aggressively round the clock to address auto thefts in the city, but the issue has become very complex because the demand for stolen cars is very high and the criminals are highly motivated. Police say carjacking has become a lucrative crime. Those taking part are usually teens, who receive about $2,000 for each stolen vehicle. There are several major highways crisscrossing the Toronto area, so a car thief can be on a freeway, usually within minutes. Police say the vehicles are ending up in trailers heading for the ports in Montreal or Halifax, and then on to the Middle East and West Africa. Interpol says Canada has become a major source of stolen cars. One measure to come out of the Ottawa summit is to share Canada's police data with other countries and with Interpol. Michael Duhem of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police says countries will then have access to this data on stolen vehicles, and with Canadian officers deployed overseas, they can develop intelligence about the organized crime groups behind the thefts. The auto industry is also being asked to improve technology to protect the vehicles from theft. In the past, the immobilizer prevented most thefts, but thieves have now gone around that by targeting a vehicle's wiring so they can access its computer. And officials say it's become astonishingly easy. Better immobilizers are in the works, but auto industry experts say that could take 3 or 4 years. Federal money is also going to the Canada Border Services Agency to give it more scope in detecting and searching shipping containers for stolen vehicles. Ontario Premier Doug Ford says he wants tougher sentences for car thieves. He says these criminals are getting out on bail once, twice, three times, or even four times, and that's unacceptable. There are even calls to put the onus on the accused in some cases to prove why they should be released on bail. But civil rights advocates say changes like that could be detrimental to the rights of the accused. Insurance companies say consumers are ultimately paying the cost of auto thefts. The industry says billions of dollars a year are going into the hands of organized crime. The Justice Minister says he's also considering options for tougher penalties for car theft. But some opposition lawmakers and critics say the summit didn't produce any real solutions to address the problem. For World Report, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Finally, we go to Turkey, a country that bridges Europe and the Middle East geographically and culturally. While the presidential election last year may have highlighted divisions there, some areas, like Taksim Square in Istanbul, show the country's intercultural side. Patrick King reports from Istanbul.
Fanning out from Taksim Square in the European quarter of Istanbul, a city that straddles many worlds, is a dense network of side streets and the 1.5-kilometre Istiklal Caddes, also known as Independence Avenue, its signature pedestrian boulevard. Here, the garish lighting from shopping chains that mark contemporary cities across the Western world mask the beauty of 19th-century buildings. Pizza Hut, McDonald's, Subway, Burger King, Starbucks, they're all here. Off the boulevard, the more alluring side streets are filled with bars, antique shops and rooftop eateries with views over the Bosphorus. The square itself encapsulates centuries of Turkish history. Following the collapse of the Ottoman Empire in 1918 and the Turkish War of Independence in 1923, construction began of the Republic Monument to commemorate the foundation of the Turkish Republic, the end of the Ottoman monarchy and the Islamic Caliphate. More recent history too. The square has not just one but two Bloody Sundays, the first in 1969 when 30,000 people marched here. Anti-American imperialism was the focus of the protests that ended in bloodshed. The second, 1977, when an estimated 500,000 people marched, pitching ultra-right-wing nationalists assisted by the state against left-wing protesters in one of the most volatile periods in recent Turkish history that echoes to this day. The events of that period did not feature in the guided tour I took down Istiklal Caddes on a chilly Saturday evening following a two-day Euromed Anna Lindh Foundation conference that seeks to promote intercultural dialogue across Europe, North Africa and the Middle East. If the conference itself struggled with what interculturalism might look and feel like in this increasingly polarised world, the streets of Istiklal Caddes seemed much more at ease with interculturalism in practice. At least, that is how it seemed at 7:30 in the evening as we made our way to one of the many restaurants of Istiklal Caddes. People strolling along. People of all ages. People at their leisure. Working people too. People coming and going. Dress codes that reflect its location at Eurasia's crossroads. Women's dress reflecting that diversity, some with the hijab, others without, a few with the chador, only one that I saw with the full burqa. But mostly women wore what seemed to my eye at least as Western clothes, although that problematic categorization might be contested by many of the women on the street. Male attire does not lend itself to such explicit cultural religious expression. American imperialism might once have been a flashpoint here, but not anymore. Jeans, that most ubiquitous of American symbols, was the order of the evening for most men. On this street, young couples, women and men, held hands. No bar here to public displays of affection. So too men and men. But this is no haven for gay men. While homosexuality is legal and Article 10 of its constitution guarantees equality of citizenship, anti-gay discrimination is rife. Inside the restaurant, men served tables. This was an all-male domain. Over dinner, conversation verged, as is often the case in international gatherings like this, from the playful to the serious. The most recognised name of any given country. For Ireland, James Joyce was the outright winner, with Oscar Wilde a distant second. After dinner, I'm back onto Istiklal Caddes. It's just after 10, and the tenor of the street has changed. So too has the demographics. Mostly, but not exclusively, young people. The alcohol-free cafe bars are teeming. We gather around glasses of Turkish tea. This time, I'm in the company of a young man from Luxembourg and a young woman from Kazakhstan, now living in Rome and representing Italy at the conference. Talk turns to politics, relations with Russia and the collapse of the Soviet Union. We roam from one cafe to another, to a bar, meeting up with some of the 30-plus delegates that make up our conference. Suddenly, it's 3 a.m., time to head for our temporary home. Istiklal Caddes has been transformed. Now the street belongs to the poor of Istanbul. Children hawking coffee and single roses. Well-wrapped babies held close to their mothers' chests. Adults hawking other goods too. It's as if the street has been given a new life, a very different life. For World Report, this is Pather King in Istanbul.
That's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Adam Maguire, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.